Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily French Show. I am your host, Nicolas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by Anlu Kiva. Anlu, how are you doing?
I'm doing wonderful, thank you, Nicolas. Happy to be back.
I'm very happy to have you back. And we also have Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. You know, slightly having a bit of a Pretoria heat wave, but other than that, it's Friday. What's not to like? We got through another week. Well done, people. No deaths. Well, at least
and
not
we're at the end
within the IRR.
Yes, so, and we're know, at the end of we're at the end of January as well. So we've even gone to the first month. Only 11 yeah. more to go. yeah, Herman. I paused when I was saying your name there for a second because I wasn't sure whether to attach a praiseworthy adjective or a demeaning adjective, and then I kind of got stuck and I couldn't decide on which one. But just imagine that I said something witty.
Story of my life. I mean, that's actually the title of my autobiography. Just imagine that I said something witty.
That's a great title. Okay, we are sponsored today by Hideco Energy, but we'll get into that after our first story. And what is our first story today? Well, it is one of the most important legislative changes in South Africa at the moment, which is, of course, the expropriation bill, or as I think we and more accurately believe it to be should be called the expropriation without compensation bill. Our colleague Chris Patterson put out a media statement today, and I'm going to read a little bit from it. President Cyril Ramaphosa's signing of the Expropriation Act threatens South Africans' economic freedom and their rights. Secure property rights are crucial to economic freedom. It gives domestic and foreign investors assurances that their investments in infrastructure and labor will be safe from government overreach, which allows them to create jobs for South Africans who are then able to provide for their families. The cycle of prosperity has been placed in grave danger. This runs in contrast to what the president actually said in the opening of parliament speech in July of 2024, when he said that the provision of title deeds provides people with assets they can use to improve their economic position, recognizing the value of property rights, something which this bill undercuts by having an open-ended list of reasons that the government can give you nil compensation for taking away property. Chris Patterson said in this release, by a stroke of the pen, the president has single-handedly destroyed the hopes of millions of future job seekers, homeowners, entrepreneurs, and business owners, and their dreams of prosperity. So those are the stakes. They are very high. But let's talk a little bit also about the politics before I get to you, Herman, to start us off with. We've seen some pushback from a number of parties to the GNU, the DA, the Freedom Front Plus, the IFP, and even the Patriotic Alliance have all attacked this bill and the way that President Ramaphosa signs it. The ANC seems to be sticking to its guns, though. The chairperson of Parliament's Public Works and Infrastructure Committee came out saying that when Minister Dean McPherson from the DA, who's in Public Works, said that he would not enact expropriation without compensation, that wasn't really his choice. She said, quote, whatever that he says, it's outside. That's his opinion. But to be honest, it's a constitutional mandate and that he would be expected to implement the law. So clearly the heels are being dug in here, which means that we're going to have to push even harder if we're going to get this bill sent back to Parliament or struck down in the courts. Herman, your thoughts on all of that, but also your thoughts on the timing of the signing of the bill. And that's something I don't think we've fully gotten into in our discussions about it here. This bill was passed by Parliament some time ago. It was sitting on the president's desk waiting to be signed into law. And it sort of seemed to be put on the back burner. It wasn't being signed. The president was talking up property rights. There was very little mention of expropriation. And then all of a sudden, he, without telling any of his partners in the GNU, goes ahead and signs the thing. Is this all just because of ANC internal politics? Or is there some sort of grander calculation that Ramaphosa, do you think, is making here?
Well, so with regards to internal ANC politics, the reality is that this is a party still recovering from a horrendous election outcome where they dropped 17 percentage points. That is remarkable. It is remarkable to lose that number of support, that level of support within a single parliamentary term. So they are still in shock. In KwaZulu-Natal and Gauteng, where they did particularly badly, the branches, the provincial executive committees, I mean, these are all in states of chaos. You see factional fighting at a regional level, but you see the regions versus the national structures. So this is a party that is at a sort of still in a state of crisis. What exactly went wrong? And with the 2026 or early 2027 local government elections creeping closer, with the DA this week, of course, announcing the start of their process to prepare for that, just to give you an idea how short the breathing space is between election seasons for these political parties. We are already heading towards that next ballot box competition, and the ANC needs to do something. Now, Ramaphosa has regularly made clear that a unified ANC is his number one priority. So there is likely some truth to the speculation that this was an act of a president who wanted to remind his party that he can still enact ANC policy, even if they are in the GNU with these other parties. I mean, think back last year, the complaints were coming through that DA ministers were eclipsing ANC ministers. So this was a party that was not fully sold on the GNU. I mean, estimates are as high as 40% of the National Executive Committee of the ANC aren't on board with the GNU. That's a sizable minority. So you have the situation where Ramaphosa, for party management purposes, had to do something ANC-ish in power at a grand level and, you know, not be seen as you know, a puppet of this GNU. And I think the timing of it coming just post Davos is likely part of that, in the sense that Davos is seen by the left wing of the ANC, or, you know, the blatantly ideological wing of the ANC, as a capitalist gathering, and for Ramaphosa to go there might be him, you know, toying with the forces of capitalism. So, you know, coming back and doing this very National Democratic Revolution thing might, you know, just restore that balance of, oh, okay, cool. He didn't.
Right. He had to cleanse himself of the taint of rubbing shoulders with investors.
Yes. He didn't pull a Mandela 1992 and just unilaterally change the ANC's attitude towards the market. So there's partly that, but I think there's also, there is a grander a narrative of the ANC remains committed to the National Democratic Revolution. This isn't some cigar-filled room type conspiracy theory. This is quite openly the basis, the vision for what the ANC has since the mid-50s imagined a prosperous and successful South Africa to be like. One where apartheid, imperialism, colonialism, and capitalism are one and the same thing. So eradicating capitalism is part of ending apartheid, is part of ending colonialism, is part of ending imperialism. And that thinking permeates, perhaps not as sophisticated as it used to in terms of the ANC's diminished intellectual capacity, but there's certainly still that mission that the National Democratic Revolution is the unstated religious devotion of the ANC in terms of where they want to take South Africa. And in that sense, the ANC has been remarkably successful over the last 30 years, progressing to expand the state, not just its size, not just its power, but also the areas of life in which it is active. In terms of the property rights, it has managed to weaken water, mineral rights, and now essentially all land rights up for grabs and not in the hands of ordinary citizens. But you see here the problem with, I think, what the tactical calculation was, that the DA is considered by the ANC as the opposition within the government. They were bullied in a way on NHI. They have been fighting NHI, the DA, in government with, I might add, some muted success. There's been a definite slowing from key departments in terms of the rapidity of which the NHI would have been implemented had it not been for, I think, the DA's role in some key clusters.
Which I think explains why Health Minister Aaron Motsoaledi seems so angry all the time, because I think he is probably feeling a little bit frustrated that he's not able to enact his will.
Exactly. So there's the NHI where they've been trying to push it, but the DA has been having some moderate, muted success. Then there's, of course, the public spat of the Bella legislation, where it seemed that the DA negotiated a bad deal. Now, if you go look at what Solidaritet and so on wanted from the DA, the end deal isn't that different. It's not wonderful, and it is still legislation of which I am particularly suspicious of. But the public perception certainly seemed that the DA could be pushed around on that. And I think there was a bit of a tactical calculation for the ANC to see, can we push them a bit further? And from what I hear from around cabinet is that the DA's negative reaction and the real entertainment of the possibility that the DA would walk away from this government did genuinely Ramaphosa's his closest allies. It seems the word was that I received that everyone in the ANC around the cabinet table seemed spooked except Gwede Mantashe. But I mean, you know, take it from whence it comes.
Take it from whence it comes.
So it's context. But the question now as to why the ANC did this, I think there's some internal party politics. Ramaphosa needed to show party unity. And Ramaphosa, I think, also needed to be assertive within his own party, showing that the presidential pen is still worth something. The fallout, I think, will become interesting over the next few weeks. I'm hearing some vague rumors from at least three parties within the GNU that the ANC, particularly Ramaphosa, might be willing to give ground on two of these three issues, Bella, NHI, and EWC. And the idea that tickles me particularly is this idea that the parliamentary committee feels so strongly that the bill should be executed, just communicates again how the ANC fundamentally misunderstands the division of powers, the separation of powers, that you've got the legislature, the judiciary, and the executive, but also that cabinet governance isn't presidential governance. We have a system that takes some presidential elements from the American congressional system or the American presidential system, but predominantly we operate within the Westminster framework, where the cabinet is the president is primus inter partes. He is the first among equals when it comes to executive function. He is the head of state in the American sense of the word, but he is also someone who has to oversee cabinet governance. This isn't just all falling on the presidential system. So the fact that McPherson has some room to maneuver is, I think, a political reality, and is, of course, also the space to watch if you want to understand the dynamics between the DA and the ANC. If McPherson can tweet or send out a post saying no expropriation under my watch and remains in position, that should tell you something about the strength of his position, the strength of the DA within the GNU, and the relative weakness of Ramaphosa. Let's put it into context. If a cabinet minister plainly refuses to execute one party's vision and that party in control cannot act against that minister, that does betray some political leverage, even though the public might not see thusly. So the question now is, will McPherson be targeted? Will he be reprimanded? I think not. And in fact, I think there might be an opportunity even for the DA to win some concessions from the ANC. So the Public Works and Infrastructure Committee, fascinating stuff, but I would advise them to seriously consider that their role isn't to be cheerleaders for the government. In fact, it is to be oversight mechanisms that represent the people. And if the public submissions on this act is anything to go by, the oversight mechanism should be, you know, aware of the fact that South Africans are no fan of the destruction of property rights.
I think I wonder whether how long the spookness of the ANC will last. They are also, Ramaphosa in particular seems to be very good at giving the impression that he's really honestly on your side, up until you find out that he isn't. And I think that is kind of his superpower, particularly when it's come to business. I think he's done a little bit with the DA as well. You know, even with the electorate to some degree, he's kind of played this thing of like,
One thing, Nick, is I think you're quite right. And we should remember that historically impressive and notable presidents and leaders like FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, famous for his style of presidential leadership, where every single person will leave the Oval Office thinking the president agrees with them. So that is a style of leadership that can be effective. Unfortunately, I think you need more political abilities than President Ramaphosa has to make that as effective.
Yeah.
But I do think that there is something to be considered in what Ramaphosa fundamentally needs. And that is, I think, a level of prestige, a level of validation. It would be a massive embarrassment for him if his government were to collapse in the year that he is the leader of the G20. I think that is perhaps for this calendar year a critical card for the DA to play, and I know they see it as such, that Ramaphosa would need the prestige and the esteem that the G20 gathering under his leadership would bring him. That means that at least until the G20 meets, you know, negotiating hand of the DA within cabinet with Ramaphosa wanting some things and not wanting other things is, you know, not insignificant.
Yes, no, I think what's often not considered in the discussions about this is if the ANC goes in with the sort of forces of chaos and radicalism in MK and the EFF, Ramaphosa specifically can kind of probably kiss his influence and career goodbye. That would essentially be him surrendering control of the party entirely, and his entire faction as well would be headed for the chopping block. So their heads are all on the line here in a way that I don't think is well understood. So, Anlu, sorry, we've been mumbling on at each other here for far too long, and I don't know how much there is left to say. Perhaps let's go back to the principle of all this. There's this kind of pushback, I think, in the media now to some degree of people saying, you know, this thing is not such a big deal. It's only targeted at land redress. It's only focus on, you know, it's only going to be farms. Don't worry about it. This is just, it's completely normal. All the countries in the world do this. Your thoughts on that and anything else we've discussed?
Thank you, Nicholas. Yeah, I think that was a very good analysis, and there's not much that I can add to it. But I think it is important to get back to what is the problem with this. And I think you've mentioned one argument, but I think another argument that I've heard float in the media, at least the last couple of weeks, is that this is the way to get property into the hands of the people who do not own so that they can improve their lives. And there are several obvious flaws in this argument or in this reasoning. It depends on the avenue you take to make the case. But what is important here, and that cannot be overstated, and Chris Patterson also made this point in the press release that you mentioned earlier, is that, for me at least, it boils down to the question of, do you want to climb the economic ladder? Or do you want to have a better life? And funny enough, turns out economic freedom is actually exactly where you need to start. And the research is so thorough on the fact that economic freedom boosts social mobility. It allows people to climb that ladder, but only when it is supported by property rights, by secure property rights. So in other words, if laws are clear, which is one of the flaws that the IRR has been pointing out with the Expropriation Act, people have better opportunity to actually improve their lives. And strong property rights are directly correlated with better working conditions. And it's, if I, yeah, so perhaps let me just quickly elaborate on that point. It might sound a little bit far-fetched, but the idea is that if people have more opportunity or a larger choice of employment opportunities, it can at the end of the day also give them better working conditions. But yeah, so that's the direct line. There's a very important indirect channel, at least, in which quality of our institutional or our institutional quality and our property rights actually increase the ability of people to have better lives, and that is through economic growth. And it is so well established that economic freedom and the protection of property rights increase your economic growth. And even if that isn't in the beginning distributed equally throughout society, it makes every single person's life better in some way. And I think a good way to explain it is the fact that the ladder that I mentioned earlier, the Expropriation Act, what it does is it takes away the first 50 steps of the ladder, and then it expects you to kind of climb it. Yeah, there's a very serious issue here. I saw something in the comments earlier, if you don't mind, I'll just quickly address it, is that the person asked whether if you owe money to the bank or your property gets expropriated, who's responsible to actually pay back whatever you owe on it? And it's a horrible answer. It's so scary because it affects every single person. And the answer is that you are still responsible for it. The idea is basically that if you're compensated for it, or whatever compensation you do receive, it should cover the debt or whatever you owe on it. But yeah, well, it was generally supposed to actually help repay your loan, say. But even if the compensation is null, then you still are responsible to repay that loan in full. And then there's obviously the risk that goes with it, that if you used your property as collateral on loans that you have, yeah, there's a very big and very serious risk for financial institutions in it as well. That's my two cents on the issue.
I really like the point you emphasized there about clarity of the law. And this is exactly one of the reasons why laws like this can be so terrible. When laws are vague or contradictory or have lots of sort of and then and so on and so forth, et cetera's in them, they create the scope for loopholes and abuse and just enormous amounts of what's called discretionary power. That is where government officials, politicians basically get their choice of reasons for why to do something. Herman, I know you had a public debate recently where this was one of the points that actually came up you were on TV explaining this, is that this is, you know, it's not just in cases where someone is speculating on land, which is the defense that's often made of this bill.
Yeah, and more than that, the level there's in law, there's the idea of jus certum, legal certainty, which forms a key part of the rule of law, because the idea is that rules should be laws or rules should be understandable, simple, so that the ordinary citizen can know whether they are acting in line with, in accordance with, or in contravention of the law. So when it comes to the question of jus certum, you really do find several levels in this law, in this act, where that breaks down. Number one, I think the most notable one is the one that Anlu, of course, or that's being alluded to here, and that's section 12.3, that makes the case that says five grounds are five grounds when met, the expropriation of land can happen with nil compensation, but the phraseology is including but not limited to these five grounds. That is truly incredible legislative drafting. That is the opposite of jus certum. That is like saying a crime in terms of this act could be anything including but not limited to the following things. I mean, that means that you've got a list of five things, but you've got literally a list of unknown other things that could be interpreted as equally valued or equally weighty in terms of the executive or the administrative decision of that act. So that's point number one. Section 12.3 is just a disaster of legal uncertainty. But then you've also got the problem, the implied legal uncertainty of who can expropriate land and property within this bill. And I'd try to count the number of expropriating authorities there are in South Africa. And I stopped counting when I got to 426. We've got at least 426 expropriating authorities in this country. If you want to call it legal certainty, that this law provides legal certainty, that it defines who can expropriate property, but the ordinary citizen might not even be aware that there are almost 500,000 expropriating authorities. That's not legal certainty. That is far from legal certainty. And I think the third issue of blatant legal uncertainty in this act is the conflict between Section 8 and Section 19 that deals with the role of the court, where it isn't clear when the court can be approached in terms of the protection of the defendant or the person who is the current owner of the property. And that is not only legally unclear and therefore legally problematic, it is also in direct contravention of Section 25(2)(b) of the Constitution that makes clear that expropriation can only take place with the approval of a court. So you need an approving court order. And on all of these grounds, and others, sadly, and others, there's just this abomination of scope for abuse. And that is why the Institute is warning of the very real risk of a new expropriation mafia gaining the upper hand in South Africa. Imagine the taxi mafia, the construction mafia, the water tank mafia. Now just add the expropriation mafia. A bunch of thugs who work for the almost 500,000 expropriating authorities who can start coercing people, bullying people, exploiting people with the power, the uncertain and largely unlimited power that this act gives them. It is not only economically dangerous, democratically dangerous, it is fundamentally cruel to people who want to aspire to become landowners or property owners at all.
And contrary to the defense of this bill, there's nothing in that bill that says that this is all just about foreign speculators or wealthy people or white farmers or anything. This is everyone is affected by this, whether you own an RDP house, whether you have a piece of land that you have a shack on, whether you own a mall or whatever, is a threat to everyone's property rights and, from top to bottom.
And can I just also add to that? Is I see someone in the comment section saying it's time to sell up and rent. Well, the problem with rent is determined by the owner of the rental property. The value of the rental property determines the risk premium connected to that property. So the owner, now being at a risk of losing that property, must, in the laws of basic economics, get some compensation for bearing a new type of risk. And how do they do that? Well, by upping the rental cost. So there's no way that people who want to live in a house can take solace in some form from this act. This act has toxicity in it that will seep through every bit of property ownership in this country, real and aspirational.
Indeed. And if your main concern in South Africa is corruption, well, I got news for you. This is going to grow corruption in a way you couldn't possibly believe because it provides so much power to bully people and to make discretionary decisions. Okay, just want to give a quick word from our sponsor, which is Hideco Energy. Are you tired of skyrocketing electricity bills and the new phenomenon of load reduction? Meet Hideco Energy, South Africa's trusted Tier 1 premium solar and backup power solution supplier With over 100 years of trading experience and the backing of a publicly listed company, Hideco Energy brings you the best quality international products to power your home or business reliably. From 3-kilowatt single-phase systems to 250-kilowatt three-phase solutions, we've got options for every need. And here's the best part. We offer unbeatable financing and rent-to-own packages designed to lower the barriers to saving money, cutting electricity costs, and ensuring power stability regardless of what's happening at Eskom. Right now, we're thrilled to offer Daily Friend listeners an exclusive promotion. Book a free or business or household audit, and they'll show you how to put more money back in your pocket without the hefty upfront costs. Reach out to them at sales@hudacoenergy.co.za. That's HUDACOENERGY.co.za. Or call them on 011-447-9864. Hideco Energy, sustainable power and storage solutions provider. We don't have time to discuss it now, but ironically, our next topic was actually going to be about Eskom and the state it's in, which is a bit complicated. It looked like it was making some recovery. We haven't had proper load shedding for a while now. But actually, just before the show, and I know that this just seems like I'm shilling for the sponsor, but this is just coincidence. Eskom announced that there's a possibility of stage 4 load shedding this weekend due to some bad luck. But I think we're going to have to save that discussion for Monday.
Nick.
Herman.
Can I very quickly, I see there's a comment here that I do need to address head on. G-Man says, fear-mongering, your little flat is not going to be expropriated. Seriously, lol. It's not what anyone's saying. I mean, G-Man, if you were listening, you would realize that I didn't mention the flat getting expropriated. But if property rights in general aren't as secure as they used to be, that infects all property rights because all property is now subject to a higher risk premium. So let's be careful when we make the assumption about, this will have a limited impact. All property is subject to being expropriated at the risk of being expropriated. The mere risk of expropriation ups the risk premium on property and therefore lowers the appeal of owning that property. That's the point I'm making. If you want to accuse us of fear-mongering, you're going to have to do better than that. And if we are going to be guilty of fear-mongering, it's only because this act is bloody frightening.
Well said. Okay, well, that's all the time we have for today. I hope that you found this show interesting and thought-provoking. And we will see you next week on the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone, and have a wonderful weekend.